Chapter 34. St. Zivilcix and Cindy. Cane fictional, claims Bournemouth man. Article in The Bournemouth Bugle, March 15, 1987. Retired gas fitter Mr. Martin Pifko made the ludicrous comment yesterday, claiming that the beloved leader of the nation was simply a fictional character come to life. Speaking from the Bournemouth home for the exceedingly odd, where he has been committed for his own protection, Mr. Pifko was more specific and likened Mr. Yorick Kane to a minor character with an over-inflated opinion of himself in a Daphne Farquhar book entitled At Long Last Lust. The Chancellor's office dubbed the report a coincidence, but ordered the Farquhar book be confiscated nonetheless. Mr. Pifko, who faces unspecified charges, made news last year when he made a similar outrageous claim regarding Cain and Goliath investing in mind control experiments. I awoke and gazed at Landon in the early morning light that had started to creep around the bedroom. He was snoring ever so softly, and I gave him a long hug before I got up, wrapped myself in a dressing gown, and tiptoed past Friday's room on my way downstairs to make some coffee. I walked into Landon's study as I waited for the kettle to boil, sat down at the piano, and played a very quiet chord. The sun crept above the roof of the house across the way at that precise moment and cast a finger of orange light across the room. I heard the kettle click off and returned to the kitchen to make the coffee. As I poured the hot water on the grounds, there was a small wail from upstairs. I paused to see if another would follow it. A single wail might be only a stirring, and Friday could be left alone. Two wails or more would be hungry boy, eager for a gallon or two of porridge. There was a second wail 10 seconds later, and I was just about to go and get him when I heard a thump and a scraping as Landon pulled on his leg and then walked along the corridor to Friday's room. There were more footsteps as he returned to his room, then silence. I relaxed, took a sip of coffee, and sat at the kitchen table, deep in thought. The superhoop was tomorrow, and I had my team. The question was, would it make a difference? There was the chance we might find a copy of At Long Last Lust, too, but I wasn't counting on this either. Of equal chance and equal risk of failure was Shakespeare's being able to unravel the Merry Wives of Elsinore, and Mycroft's coming up with an Ovi Negator at short notice. But none of these pressing matters was foremost in my mind. Most important to me was that at 11 o'clock this morning, Cindy would try to kill me, for the third and final time. She would fail, and she would die. I thought of Spike and Betty, and picked up the phone. I figured he'd be a heavy sleeper, and I was right. Cindy answered the phone. It's Thursday. This is professionally very unethical, said Cindy in a sleepy voice. What's the time?
6:30. Listen, I rang to suggest that it'd be a good idea if you stayed at home today and didn't go to work. There was a pause.
I can't do that, she said at last. I've arranged childcare and everything. But there's nothing to stop you getting out of town and never returning.
This is my town too, Cindy.
Leave now, or the next family crypt will be up for a dusting.
I won't do that.
Then, replied Cindy with a sigh, we've got nothing else to discuss. I'll see you later, although I doubt you'll see me.
The phone went dead, and I gently replaced the receiver. I felt sick.
The wife of a good friend would die, and it didn't feel good. "What's the matter?" said a voice close at hand. "You seem upset."
It was Mrs. Tiggywinkle. "No," I replied, "everything's just as it should be. Thanks for dropping round. I found us a William Shakespeare. He's not the original, but close enough for our purposes. He's in this cupboard." I opened the cupboard door, and a very startled Shakespeare looked up from where he'd been scribbling by the light of a candle end he had stuck upon his head. The wax had begun to run down his face. but he didn't seem to mind.
Mr. Shakespeare, this is the hedgehog I was telling you about.
He shut his notebook and stared at Mrs. Tiggywinkle. He wasn't the slightest bit afraid or surprised. After the abominations he'd dodged on an almost daily basis in Area 21, I suspect a 6-foot-high hedgehog was something of a relief. Mrs. Tiggywinkle curtsied gracefully.
"Delighted to make your acquaintance, Mr. Shakespeare," she said politely. "Will you come with me, please?"
"Who was that?" Landon called out as he walked downstairs a little later.
It was Mrs. Tiggywinkle picking up a William Shakespeare clone in order to save Hamlet from permanent destruction.
"You can't ever be serious, can you?" he laughed as he gave me a hug.
I had smuggled Shakespeare into the house without Landon seeing. "I know you're meant to be honest and truthful to your spouse, but I thought there might be a limit, and if there was, I didn't want to reach it too soon." Friday came down to breakfast 10 minutes later. He looked tousled, sleepy, and a bit grumpy.
"Quis nostrud laboris," he moaned. "Nisi ut aliquip ex consequat."
I gave him some toast and rummaged in the cupboard under the stairs for my bulletproof vest. All my stuff was now back in Landon's house, as if I had never moved out. Side slips are confusing, but you can get used to almost anything.
"Why are you wearing a bulletproof vest?"
It was Landon. Drat. I should have put it on at the station.
"What bulletproof vest?"
"The one you're trying to put on."
"Oh, that one. No reason. Listen, if Friday gets hungry, you can always give him a snack. He likes bananas. You may have to buy some more. And if a gorilla calls, it's only that Mrs. Bradshaw I was telling you about."
"Don't change the subject. How can you go to work wearing a vest for no reason?"
"It's a precaution."
"Insurance is a precaution. A vest means you're taking unnecessary risks."
"I'd be taking a bigger one without it."
"What's going on Thursday?"
I waved a hand vaguely in the air and tried to make light of it.
"Just an assassin. A small one. Barely worth thinking about."
"Which one?"
"I can't remember. Window something."
"The window maker? A contract with her and stick to reading short stories? 67 known victims?"
68, if she did Samuel Pring."
"That's not important. Why didn't you tell me?"
I didn't want you to worry."
He rubbed his face with his hands and stared at me for a moment, then sighed deeply.
"This is the Thursday next I'm married, isn't it?"
I nodded my head. He wrapped his arms around me and held me tightly.
"Will you be careful?" he whispered in my ear.
"I'm always careful."
"No, really careful. The sort of careful that you should be when you have a husband and a son who'd be supremely pissed off if they were to lose you."
"Ah," I whispered back. "That sort of careful."
"Yes, I will." We kissed, and I velcroed up the vest, put my shirt over the top of it, and my shoulder holster on top of this. I kissed Friday and told him to be good, then kissed Landon again. "I'll see you this evening," I told him. "And that's a promise." I drove to Wanborough to find Joffy. He was officiating at a GSD civil union ceremony, and I had to wait in the back of the temple until he had finished. I had some time before I had to deal with Cindy, and looking more closely into St. Zivilkix seemed like a good way to fill it. Millen's idea that Zivilkix wasn't a seer, but a rogue member of the Chrono Guard, involved in some sort of time crime, seemed, on the face of it, unlikely. You couldn't hide from the Chrono Guard. They would always find you. Perhaps not here and now, but then and there, when you least expected it. Long before you even thought about doing something wrong. Plus, the Chrono Guard left no trace. With the perpetrator gone, then the time crime never happened either. Very neat, very clever. But with the historical record so closely scrutinized, and the Chrono Guard itself giving Zivilkix the seal of approval, how on earth did Zivilkix, if he was a fake, get around the system?
"Hello, doofus," said Joffy,
as the happy couple kissed outside the temple to a shower of confetti. "What brings you here?"
"St. Zivilkix. Where is he?"
"He got the bus into Swindon this morning. Why?"
I outlined my suspicions.
"Zivilkix? A rogue member of the Chrono Guard? But why? What's he up to? Why risk permanent eradication for dubious fame as a 13th-century seer?"
"How much did he get from the Toast Marketing Board?"
25 grand.
"Hardly a fortune.
Can we look in his room?" "Outrageous," replied Joffy. "I would be guilty of a shameful breach of trust if I were to allow a room search in his absence. I have a spare key here."
Zivilkix's room was much as you would suppose a monk's cell to be, Spartan in the extreme. He slept on a mattress stuffed with straw, and had only a table and chairs furniture. On the table was a Bible. It was only after we started searching that we found a CD Walkman under the mattress, along with a few copies of Big and Bouncy and Fast Horse.
"A betting man?" I asked.
"Drinking, betting, smoking, wenching. He did it all."
"The magazines show he can read English, too. What are you looking for, Joff?" Joffy had been opening the drawers of his desk and looking under the pillow.
"His Book of Revealments. He usually hides it here."
"So, you've searched this room before. Suspicious?"
Joffy looked sheepish. "I'm afraid so. His behaviour is less like a saint's and more like, well, a cheap vulgarian's. When I translate, I have to make certain adjustments."
I pulled out his desk drawer and turned it over. Stuck to the bottom was an envelope. Bingo. It contained a single one-way gravitube ticket, all the way to Bali. Joffy raised his eyebrows, and we exchanged nervous glances. Zivilkix was definitely up to something. Joffy accompanied me into Swindon, and we drove up and down the streets trying to find the wayward saint. We visited the site of his old cathedral at Tesco's, but couldn't find him. So we went on a circuit that took in the law courts, the Spec Ops building, and the theatre, before driving past the university and down Commercial Road. Joffy spotted him outside Pete and Dave's, lumbering up the street.
"There!
I see him." We abandoned the car, and trotted to keep up with the scruffy figure dressed in only a blanket. It was just bad luck that he glanced furtively behind and spotted us. He darted across the street. I don't know whether his lank and uncut hair had got in his eyes, or he had forgotten about traffic during his stay in the Dark Ages, but he didn't look where he was going, and ran straight in front of a bus. His head cracked the windscreen, and his bony body was thrown sideways onto the pavement with a thump. Joffy and I were the first on the scene. A younger man might have survived relatively unscathed, but Zivilkix, his body weakened through poor diet and disease, didn't stand much of a chance. He was coughing and crawling with all the strength he could muster to the entrance of the nearest shop.
"Here's here, your grace,"
murmured Joffy, laying a hand on his shoulder and stopping him moving.
"You're going to be all right."
"Bollocks," said Zivilkix, in a state of exasperation. "Bollocks, bollocks, bollocks. Survive the plague to get hit by a sodding number 23 bus. Bollocks."
"What did he say?"
"He's annoyed."
"Who are you?" I said. "Are you Chrono Guard?" His eyes flicked across to mine and he groaned. Not only dying, but dying and rumbled. He made another attempt to reach the doorway and collapsed.
"Someone call for an ambulance!" yelled out Joffy.
"It's too late for that," he muttered. "Too late for me. Too late for all of us. This wasn't how it was meant to turn out. Time is out of joint, and it won't be for me to set it right. Ah, well, Joffy, take this and use it wisely, as I would not have done. Bury me in the grounds of my cathedral, and don't tell them who I was. I lived a sinner, but I'd like to die a saint. Oh, and if a fat slapper named Shirley tells you I promised her £1,000, she's a bloody liar.
He coughed again, shivered for a moment, and stopped moving. I placed my hand on his grimy neck, but could feel no pulse.
What did he say?
Something about an overweight lady named Shirley, time being out of joint, and using his revealments as I see fit.
What did he mean by that? That his revealment is not going to come true?
I don't know, but he handed me this.
It was Zivilkix's book of revealments. Joffy flicked through the yellowed pages, which outlined in Old English every supposed prophecy he had made, next to an arithmetic sum of some sort. Joffy closed Zivilkix's eyes and placed his jacket over the dead saint's head. A crowd had assembled, including a policeman, who took charge. Joffy hid the book, and we stood to one side as the blare of an ambulance started up in the distance. The owner of the shop had come out and told us that having tramps dying on his doorstep was bad for business, but changed his mind when he found out who it was.
"My goodness," he said with a respectful tone. "Imagine, a real live saint honouring us with his death on our doorstep."
I nudged Joffy and pointed to the shop front. It was a betting shop.
"Typical," snorted Joffy. "If he didn't die trying to get to the bookies, it would have been a brothel. The only reason I knew he wouldn't be at the pub is because it's not opening time."
Startled, I looked at my watch. It was 10:50. Cindy. I had been thinking about St. Zivilkix so much, I had forgotten all about her. I backed into the doorway and glanced around. No sign of her, of course, but then she was the best. I thought the fact that a crowd had gathered was good, as she would be unlikely to want to kill innocent people, but then changed my mind when I realized that Cindy's creed of respect for innocent life could be written in very large letters on the back of a matchbox. I had to get away from the crowd in case someone else was hurt. I dashed off up Commercial Road and was approaching the corner of Granville Street when I stopped abruptly. Cindy had walked around the corner. My hand reflexively closed around the butt of my gun, but then I stopped, all of a sudden uncertain. She was not alone. She had Spike with her.
"Well," said Spike, looking beyond me to the melee on the street behind, "what's going on here?"
"The death of Zivilkix, Spike." I was staring at Cindy, who stared back at me. I could see only one of her hands. The other was hidden in her handbag. She had failed twice. How far would she go to kill me? In broad daylight? With her husband as witness? I was standing awkwardly with my hand on my automatic, but it was still in its holster. I had to trust my father. He had been right about Cindy on the previous attempt. I pulled out my gun and pointed it at her. There was a gasp from several passers-by who scattered.
"Thursday?" yelled Spike. "What the hell is going on? Put that down."
"No, Spike. Cindy isn't a librarian. She's the window maker." Spike looked at me, then at his petite wife, and laughed.
"Cindy? An assassin? You're joking." "She's delusional, and I'm frightened, Spikey,"
whimpered Cindy, in her best pathetic girly voice.
"I don't know what she's talking about. I've never even held a gun."
"Very slowly, take your hand out of your handbag, Cindy." But it was Spike who made the next move. He pulled out his gun and pointed it at me. "Put down the gun, Furs. I've always liked you, but I have no problem making this choice." I bit my lip, but did not stop staring at Cindy. "Ever wondered why she was paid cash to do those freelance library jobs? Why her brother works for the CIA? Why her parents were killed by police marksmen? Have you ever heard of librarians being killed by the police?"
"There's an explanation for it all, Spikey,"
whined Cindy.
"Kill her, she's mad."
I saw her game now. She wasn't even going to do the job herself. In broad daylight, her husband pulls the trigger, and it's all legal. A good man defending his wife. She was good. She was the best. She was the window maker. A contract with her, and you're deader than corduroy.
She has a contract out on me, Spike. Already tried to kill me on two occasions.
Put down the gun, Thursday.
Spikey, I'm frightened.
Cindy, I want to see both your hands. Drop the gun, Thursday.
We had reached an impasse. As I stood there with Spike pointing a gun at my head, and with me pointing a gun at Cindy's, I realized this was quite possibly the worst situation to be in. If I lowered my gun, Cindy would kill me. If I didn't lower my gun, Spike would kill me. If I killed Cindy, Spike would kill me. Try as I might, I couldn't think of a scenario that didn't end in my own death. Tricky, to say the least. And it was then that the grand piano fell on her. I'd never heard a piano falling 30 feet onto concrete before, but it was exactly as I imagined. A sort of musical concussion that reverberated around the street. As chance would have it, the piano, a Steinway baby, I learned later, missed us all. It was the stool that hit Cindy, and she went down like a sack of coal. One look at her, and we both knew it was bad. A serious head wound and a badly broken neck. It was a time of mixed emotions for Spike. Grief and shock at the accident, but also realization that I had been right. Still clasped in Cindy's hand was a silenced .38 revolver.
No!
Yelled Spike, placing his hand gently upon her pale cheek. Not again! Cindy groaned weakly as the policeman who had been dealing with St. Zivilkicks rushed up with two paramedics at his side.
You should have told me,
Spike muttered, refusing to look at me, his powerful shoulders quivering slightly as tears rolled down his cheeks. I'm so sorry, Spike. He didn't reply, but moved aside so the paramedics could try to stabilize her.
Who is she? Asked the policeman. In fact, who are you two?
Spec Ops, we said in unison, producing our badges.
And this is Cindy Stoker, said Spike sadly. The assassin known as the window maker.
And my wife.